it feels more comfortable to look at a very successful company in your category and say, this brand did it this way and they were very successful. So let's try to be as close to that as possible. But then you lose so much of your own voice and authenticity when you do that. And yes, it feels less scary in the moment, but you really diminish your chances of success and your chances of making a real impression on people.
Hey there. Welcome to Lessons in Creativity, where we'll explore the creative process across different disciplines and learn how to harness this natural part of our human experience. I'm Jenna Massey, your fellow student and host. In this episode, I spoke with Esther Jang. Esther is a brand and product marketer who was an early employee at Venmo and helped shape the brand from the very beginning. Since then, she's worked with many fintech startups building their brands from scratch. In this episode, Esther talks about brand evolution, the bravery needed to launch a brand, allowing space for crazy ideas, and more. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Welcome, Esther. So excited to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me, Jenna. I'm very excited to talk to you about creativity today.
Well, to start, I'd love to take you back to yourself as a child, maybe age 7, 8, 9, and think about in what ways creativity came out for you at that time.
Sure. I'll share this story. Hopefully it's encouraging for people out there questioning their own innate creative skills. But as a child, my mom actually enrolled my younger sister and I into an art class. And this was when we were living in Korea. And the art teacher went back to my mom and said, you know, the younger one has some innate talent for art. The older one, not so much. So my mom actually pulled me from the art class and told me, you know, it's better for me to focus on the things that I have some talent in. So I grew up very much thinking that I was not creative or talented in that way. And it really wasn't until I was much older that I realized creativity comes in many different forms. And for some people, it comes out in art. For some people, it comes out in storytelling. For some people, it comes out in problem solving. So I wouldn't have called myself a creative child necessarily.
At what point then did you start to rediscover that part of yourself?
It was probably when I was at Venmo. So at Venmo, I started out in an operations role and was leveraging my consulting background to help with product strategy and operational efficiency. And then I started becoming more and more interested in marketing and thinking about Venmo as a brand and what that meant for our users and how we as a company could be a little bit more proactive in shaping that brand. And that's sort of where I brought more creative thinking into work and leveraging more creative problem solving to figure out, you know, what can this brand be and, you know, how do we want it to be represented in the world? And I found that marketing was just such a wonderful way to marry the operation side of my brain with more of the creative side of my brain.
I love that. Having worked with you, I see that.
Thank you.
So what was it like to build the brand at Venmo?
Yeah, Venmo was such a roller coaster. So I was there as a very early employee and stayed with them for, I think, a little over 4 years post PayPal acquisition. And in that time, the brand went through many phases, I would say. So in the very early days, the brand attracted mostly people that I would describe as a little bit shady. So it kind of gained this reputation for being a great way to rack up credit card points. So back in the day, you could add your credit card to Venmo and pay rent to your landlord on Venmo and rack up all these credit card points without paying a credit card fee. So we had a ton of those users. That was like our primary use case and most of our payments volume. And we also attracted a lot of people who were selling goods that were perhaps not so legal. And, you know, that's kind of the reputation it was gaining. And I think early on, we started as a team thinking, okay, we don't want the brand to continue on this path. And we need to be a little bit more proactive about shaping the brand. So thankfully, we had a really wonderful data engineering team and fraud and risk team who were able to identify those users and shut down accounts accordingly. It was also in these very early days at Venmo that I learned FinDoms were.
Okay, so what is a FinDom?
So a FinDom is a financial dominatrix. And this was just one type of user that we were seeing a lot of on the social feed. And we were all for people having their own private preferences. But it became a business problem because we were getting such a high volume of support inquiries where people were asking us to, you know, return their funds, like, hey, you know, I didn't mean to make this payment. But then when we went through their history, it became very apparent that they were in a relationship with a FinDom and actually these payments were consensual. So
don't see that every day.
Yeah. So I learned about a lot of different types of people in the early days at Venmo and learned a lot about people's relationship with money in ways that I, you know, never knew existed. So that was a really fun time. So that was kind of the first phase of the Venmo brand where it got away from us. And I would say as we became more established, we really embraced the brand as being a tool for millennials and really easy way for people to make payments with their friends, going out to dinner, you know, splitting rent, splitting groceries. It was really popular among couples who were splitting expenses. So we really embraced that identity of being like the preferred payments tools for young people. And then I think once the brand became very, very popular among a younger demographic, it started gaining traction with older people whose kids were maybe on Venmo, whose kids were going to college and, you know, needed money from their parents on a monthly basis. And we tried to figure out how to strike a nice balance between being inclusive, but also being viewed as this cool hip tool for younger people. So that's really what made me start thinking about the brand in a different way. You know, how do we as a company help shape the narrative of the brand? Mm. When you think of a brand as a person, maybe it goes from being like a young person to an adolescent person to an adult. Mm. And what does that look like for the company?
As that audience matured, what tactics or strategies did you use on the brand team to try to move the audience to a more mature customer base?
Yeah, I think a lot of it was actually less on the brand marketing side and more on the product marketing side. Mm-hmm. So as a product marketer, you had to be more thoughtful about the copy you were using in app, for example, mm-hmm. right? Like how do you use language that is much more easily understood by an older audience? Or how do you create a user experience in the app that's more intuitive for people who didn't necessarily grow up with smartphones? So as the product matured, it became more and more important to have really great product marketers on the team who were thinking about including more people.
So I have the benefit of having worked with you. So I have a lot of your own phrases. So one of them is throw a goat.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm curious, at Venmo, do you have any examples of a campaign that you're particularly proud of or a time when you've thrown a goat? And if you would explain that phrase.
Well, let me explain a little bit also where that phrase comes from, because credit where credit is due. So prior to working at the wealth tech company where you and I both worked, I was at a private equity firm called Alpine Investors. And the partners at Alpine, I think they were really big fans of Monty Python. And they loved that scene where there are two warring peoples. One of the civilizations is like behind their castle wall and the other civilization is about to attack and they have a huge army and lots of supplies and the people behind the wall are getting kind of desperate and running out of supplies and they're like, oh no, what do we do? And one of the guys says, you know, well, let's throw a goat over the wall just to show them how much food and supplies we have that we're willing to just waste this goat by throwing it over the wall. And it ends up scaring away the other army. So whenever we wanted people to come up with crazy ideas like that, we would just tell them like, hey, throw a goat. And that really stuck with me because I thought it was just so funny. Even just the visual is so vivid, you know? So yeah, that I'm glad to have brought that phrase with me to many different places that I've worked since then. In terms of throwing goats at Venmo, one unexpected campaign was the Lucas campaign. So people who lived in New York City circa 2013, 2014 may remember seeing on the New York City subway a poster with this Asian guy who had a bit of a double-y beard. And the poster said, "Lucas takes the stairs," or "Lucas waters his plants." And then there would just be the Venmo logo, but no mention of what Venmo was or who Lucas was. And we just plastered Lucas's face all over the New York City subway. And it became so polarizing that it actually really kind of blew up the brand in New York City.
Wow.
And it's so funny because we didn't plan to do that campaign. It was actually a campaign that was launched because there was leftover marketing budget. And Lucas, you know, people always ask, oh, who was Lucas? Why Lucas? And he was an engineer on the team, and he was chosen because his name sounded good in the campaign.
That's hysterical.
And the reason he had some stubble or like a little bit of a beard is because it was around when Movember was happening and we were doing fundraising for Movember.
Oh my gosh.
So much of it was not intentional. But yeah, it just became this huge success and people really loved it. But also many people really hated it. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a really important marketing lesson in there where, you know, the takeaway is, in order to really make an impression, you have to do something that will be polarizing, most likely. And that's going to make a lot of founders uncomfortable. And I think as someone who's run marketing at many different startups, I always have this challenging conversation with founders where I have to get them comfortable with doing things that are different and potentially polarizing so that they can make an impression.
Those are two really interesting points. I think the throw a goat in particular, when you think about the creative process and doing something without knowing if it's going to work and really taking a risk, that applies to so many different things. And when you have the opportunity to do something big like that with a brand, I think that's incredible. You just never know what's going to come of it.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. It can be really scary though, right? Because in Monty Python, maybe that was 2 days worth of food for soldiers, you know? So it feels scary. And I think companies should encourage employees taking those risks and, you know, ensure that employees feel safe making mistakes, because that's really when those genius moments will come out.
Absolutely. And the second point you made is on the polarizing campaign, which is something I was going to ask you about, because having worked with you too, I love that when you rolled out a new brand, you said, "I need someone to hate it." And I think that's just so interesting too, in sharing any creative work, like you're going to have judgment and you're going to have people that disagree and that don't like what you've done. And to your point on it being scary, that's a whole other set of emotions that comes with that piece of it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you definitely need to have a thick skin as a brand marketer and as a founder or entrepreneur, because what person has done something amazing and lasting that hasn't garnered some fan base or base of people who hold them in effigy, potentially?
Yeah. So you were just starting to go into working with early stage founders. And since your time at Venmo, you've worked at a couple of different startups and helped them build their brand really from scratch, from beginning to end. What is that process like working with founders early on and essentially working with the creative teams and the PR teams? What does that process look like for you, and what's it been like for you?
As a marketer, that's really my favorite place to be. I love working with startups who are trying to figure out their identity and how that identity manifests as a brand. I think that's kind of where companies have a lot of freedom to explore what their brand could be and how they want to make people feel. So it's just a really fun process for me. I would say the most challenging aspect of it is founders sometimes think they know what they want, but don't, or they think they know what will resonate, and then they're proven wrong. It definitely comes with its challenges, but I think it's definitely the most exciting place to be.
How do you work with founders like that? Because I think the challenging part of brand marketing is there's a lot of it that is subjective and taste driven.
Mm-hmm.
How do you steer someone one way or another and trust your instincts or trust their instincts or bring in data to support? What are some of the ways that you go about that?
I think the first step is always to have the founder, in their words, describe what they think the brand should feel like for people. So okay. I always try to start with the feeling that they're trying to generate. Do you want the brand to feel very serious and responsible? Or do you want the brand to feel a little bit more fun and youthful, right? Like, what is the feeling that you're trying to capture with the brand? And then we go really deep on details like, okay, who is the target audience? Who is the ideal user of this product or service? What are their interests, right? So if your target audience is Gen Z, you know, they're constantly on their phones and they're looking for something that's a little more attention grabbing or, you know, feels a little bit more like eye candy, and they're not so concerned about things being serious and well established, right? They're willing to try new things. You know, maybe it doesn't make sense to have a brand that feels very austere or old establishment, old guard. So just making sure those two things are very aligned and showing the founder, hey, here are potentially some discrepancies in what you're trying to do, or here's where we can create more harmony between these two things. And then we get into things like, what is the story that you're trying to tell people? Like, why did you start this company and why should people care? And at the end of the day, I think regardless of what demographic you're in or what age group you're in, you're going to want to use a product or service that is coming from a place of authenticity. And I think people catch on really quickly when companies are trying to simply emulate someone else's brand. And I think one challenge for founders, and I really sympathize, is it feels more comfortable to look at a very successful company in your category and say, oh, well, you know, this brand did it this way and they were very successful. So let's try to be as close to that as possible, right? But then you lose so much of your own voice and authenticity when you do that. And yes, it feels less scary in the moment, but you really diminish your chances of success and your chances of making a real impression on people.
I think I was reading somewhere recently that in making movies, the movies that are the ones that truly come from the artist, mm-hmm. and not from looking at like, okay, what do audiences want, or what do, you know, what are other movies doing? The ones that come from someone who's writing something unique, a unique story, are the ones that actually do better.
Right.
It's this fine line in marketing because you obviously want to understand your customer base, your audience, and get a sense of their wants and needs. But if you get too far away from that authenticity, you start to dilute the brand.
Exactly.
You can't listen to everyone's judgment. You have to know where to draw the line.
And I think as a marketer, it takes a little bit of time, but generally I get a sense of when a founder is going to suffer a lot of whiplash. So wanting to emulate this company and then 6 months later wanting to emulate that company. And, you know, I will say the founders at Venmo, and I think part of the reason I had such a great experience at Venmo is because the founders were very good at focusing on who they wanted to be and what they wanted Venmo to be in the world versus looking at every other competitor that was coming out on the market at that time. And there were a lot of very legitimate, intimidating competitors coming out with peer-to-peer payment tools. So, you know, at one point Google entered the game and then Apple entered the game and all of these new startups were emerging, and Venmo really created the fintech category. The phrase fintech did not exist when we started Venmo. So I think when I look at startups that that are seeking my marketing expertise, I really look for founders who have that commitment to the brand that they want to be and the person that they are versus someone who's trying to emulate a brand that already exists.
So you also have a really high bar for quality in the website creation, the design, really every part of it. How do you convince founders to place value, first of all, on creating the brand in general? And then if they're not willing to, curious if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think it's different for everyone, but I'm thinking back to when I was at the private equity firm, Alpine Investors. So all of the founders at Alpine, you know, they had been in private equity for a very long time. And in the private equity space, branding is not that important. It's much mm-hmm. more about return on investment and performance, which is kind of the opposite of, you know, the VC landscape. But to their credit, they were very open to trying something different. Mm-hmm. And they were very skeptical at first on the value of, for example, having very nice business cards. And this was something that I was really pushing for. I wanted very high quality paper, white foil embossed cards and
attention to detail.
it was all about the details. And, you know, they were asking, you know, is this really a good use of budget? But to their credit, they kind of let me run with it. And one of the partners went to a conference with the new business cards, and he sent me an email after that conference and he said, "Never have I been to a conference where someone complimented me on my business card and several other people said, oh, you guys must be doing very well these days." And that was very validating for me. And I really appreciated that he sent me that email, because a feeling is so tangible, right? And when you share your brand in the format of a website or a business card, that is the impression that you're giving mm-hmm. to someone of how your company is doing and what you stand for. And, you know, everyone can relate to what it feels like to see something nice versus seeing something that's plain and ordinary.
Yeah, I love that you said feeling is so important.
Yeah, like everybody has emotions.
So often in the business world, and especially in the finance and investing world, people are under the illusion that they're making decisions off of things like returns, when in reality, like so much of it is driven by emotions and comparison to others, their own feelings about their financial situation or whatnot. If people would acknowledge that, then you understand just how important things like brand marketing and product marketing are.
I totally agree. I think especially for people who are in finance or managing money or making things like trading decisions, the sooner you recognize that your emotions do play a role in your decision making, the smarter you will be about potentially keeping those emotions in check or understanding how to manage those emotions, right? And so if I had the choice between investing my money with the CIO who says, I recognize that I have emotions, but I have these strategies in place to keep myself from making bad decisions, I would much prefer to give my money to him than to a CIO who says, you know, I really don't have emotions. I'm a completely rational human being, right? Because that's just not realistic.
Yeah, such a great point. That really connects so much to the value that people place on marketing and brand in general. How do you think now with AI coming out, what impact do you see on brand creation and marketing that AI can play? And what part do you think will still remain important for humans to be involved?
Yeah, that's a great question and one that I've been thinking about a lot recently. I've been reading a lot of articles about how AI will completely replace marketers in the future. And obviously, as a marketer, that does cause some anxiety. But when I think about the aspects of marketing that are very difficult to replicate, if you're a machine, it's really around kind of managing the feelings of stakeholders involved. As a person with emotions and empathy, even I have a very challenging time sometimes getting founders to be brave and have the courage to do something different.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine a scenario where a founder will ask an AI to produce a concept for a brand and be able to kind of make that leap of faith based on what a machine is spitting out. I think AI will do a great job of producing a lot of different potential ideas for people. I think it can do a great job with things like product marketing, copy editing. So those aspects of marketing, I think I already do leverage AI tools in a lot of my freelance marketing work. But so much of creating a great brand has to do with managing people's emotions and aligning various stakeholders. And I think that's going to be very difficult for an AI to do, at least in the near term, at least in my lifetime.
You bring up such a great point on, like, it's one thing to come up with an idea or come up with throw a goat type idea, but to actually then do it is, I think, what is so challenging. And it applies across really any creative field. I think about artists and musicians who put out their music and like the bravery that they have to be so vulnerable with what they're putting out into the world.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing's really true with founders in the business world. And that's why it is so important to have people like you that are knowledgeable, not only in the brand marketing side, but also in the like the human side of, hey, actually, how do you get over this and, mm-hmm. and do it?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, having worked with brilliant creative partners as well, you know, for example, I've worked with Mucho, which is a design agency, many times throughout my career. And Rob Duncan, one of the partners there, you know, he does such a wonderful job of not only creating different concepts for a brand, but ensuring that there's a lot of cohesion throughout mm-hmm. all of the different pieces of collateral or marketing assets that a company might need. And that's another aspect that I think would be very difficult for AI to replicate, right? Like it's, I think, very challenging to ask a machine to say, given that the brand and logo looks like this, does this type of website feel the same for people? Right? Like how does AI evaluate that feeling?
Absolutely. How do you approach launching a brand once you've created it and done all the work to get it together? What does the brand unveiling look like?
Yeah, brand unveiling can look different depending on the company. So for something that is a consumer-facing product, you have the room to be a little bit more splashy and loud, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So it can look like anything from social media campaign to TV ads. We did a lot of different billboards back in the day at Venmo, which sounds so old school, but they were actually pretty successful when we were trying to gain traction in markets where we weren't as popular. So for example, like Chicago and Austin. And then on the B2B side of things, it can look quite different. It might be more in the form of direct email communication with clients or potential clients. It might be in the form of LinkedIn rather than Instagram or TikTok, for example. It really just depends on the brand, I think.
What's your favorite part of brand marketing?
I think, you know, I mentioned earlier that I had worked with this creative agency, Mucho, several times throughout my career. I think one of my favorite parts is really having the opportunity to work with so many different creative minds throughout the process. So, for example, I've also worked with really wonderful videographers. There's a guy, Amon Johnson, who's based in Austin, Texas, who I love working with because he does such a wonderful job of bringing a brand's voice into video collateral. I love working with brilliant copywriters who come up with really catchy phrases for the brand. It just really exposes me to people who bring so much creativity to the table. So it's, you know, it's a bit unfair for me to say as a brand marketer that I'm the one who's coming up with all of these brilliant ideas. It really is such a collaborative effort, which I love.
So how does creativity show up for you outside of work? I know you have a couple of other hobbies as well.
Yeah, I, you know, like I mentioned, I think as someone who didn't think of myself as a creative person as a child, it wasn't until adulthood that I gave myself another chance to be creative. So for example, during the pandemic, I started picking up watercoloring, which I really fell in love with. You know, will I ever be an artist that's featured in a gallery? Probably not, but it's still a wonderful outlet. You know, I have tried multiple blogs in the past, and lately I've been thinking of picking up mocktail making. So
I love it.
I just recently bought a mocktail making set, and I'm going to give that a try. So my friends describe me as someone who has tried the most hobbies on the planet. Like at one point I tried flower arranging, you know, it's just kind of all over the place.
We might have to compete for that.
Yeah, I think more people should make space and time in their day-to-day lives to do, even if it's just like one thing that's creative. I think it's just done so much for my mental health and overall well-being.
Yeah, it really is a form of expression that just feeds your soul.
Definitely.
And I think what's also a common thread for you is you bring such empathy into the work environment.
Well, thank you.
Of course. And you bring this coaching mentality working with leaders in launching brands. Outside of work, you explore a lot of things on your own. And you've got this interest in wellness. And I'm curious where that came from, where that awareness and intention behind empathy really came from.
I had a very competitive academic environment as a child. So I went to a science and math high school in New York City, and then went to Wellesley and then Wharton. And I spent so much of my young adult life competing and focused on being the best and getting to the top. And in my Venmo days, I was actually a very polarizing person. So this is my dirty little secret from my past. So I assure you, if you were to interview people from Venmo back in the day, there are people that either loved working with me because I was very efficient, very hardworking, and really gave everything to Venmo. But there were also people who hated me because I just had such a low tolerance for what I felt was laziness or inefficiency or incompetence. And I was not quiet about making my feelings known. So, you know, I think I got a lot of feedback from some wonderful mentors that I had throughout my career who really coached me on, you know, having a healthier balance. And I'm very open to feedback. And I think at some point in my career, I just thought something needs to change. It's not about other people, right? It's about me and my own mentality. And what are some ways that I can strike a better balance in my life? And I ended up taking a wellness coaching certification program. And I didn't take it with the intention of becoming a wellness coach myself. It was more about giving myself tools to, you know, achieve wellness in my own life. And I think it really worked. So I would recommend it for anyone who is feeling burnt out or feels like they're getting a lot of feedback that they're prickly or potentially not pleasant to work with because they're just expecting a lot from other people and not striking a healthy balance in their own lives, to just take a step back, learn some tools to better manage your own emotions and achieve wellness. And you can then kind of emanate and share that with the world.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. It's really interesting to hear your journey and how you've grown, having really only seen you already. Wonderful.
I think honestly, Jenna, I also, after turning 30, I was like, I'm too tired to be prickly.
Yeah, like you start to let some of it go.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's true. It's like you're holding on to so much by trying to control others. And so I love that you kind of took that responsibility back on yourself. What do you think's been one of the biggest changes or things that you've implemented or tools that worked for you?
Actually, there's a really great Hidden Brain episode about this. There's an episode about emotions and where emotions come from. And they talk about how when you feel nervous or anxious or angry, it's less about the external factor making you feel that way, right? So it's not fair to say, oh, Jenna did this thing and it made me angry, because the anger is more coming from a place of your brain making predictions about what's going to happen next in response to what the other person did. So I always try to catch myself in that moment and say, okay, this person did this thing. Why is it making me angry or stressed or cranky? And then it helps me understand, oh, it's actually because I'm nervous that now we're not going to make this project deadline. Or, you know, I'm nervous that more work is going to fall onto my plate because the other person did this thing, right? So it's more about my predictive inner machine working and telling me to feel a certain way.
Yeah.
And then once I recognized that happening, I became much better at communicating to people, hey, you did this thing and it's making me feel this way. What are some ways that we can solve that together? Yeah, so that's a tool that's really helped me.
It's amazing how those processes and tools take so long to ingrain within yourself. And then also trying to, I think there's so much power in trying to bring shared language and the people that you're working with in recognizing like, hey, we all do this. We're all not going to be perfect. And let's work together to address these changes and have some grace for one another. It's at a meta level, a very interesting process.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think definitely I try to find those people in the workplace.
Who are willing to do that with you.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I'm curious how your view of creativity has changed over your life and career.
I think when I was younger, I defined creativity as being a very specific thing. So when hiring people on my marketing teams, I would ask for things like a design portfolio or, you know, let me see your social media accounts. But now that I'm older and having managed more types of people, I've come to recognize creativity comes in many different forms. So I think I'm much better now at hiring people who have a certain type of creativity that may not be immediately recognizable. So for example, on my last team, I hired a growth marketer, this woman, Camille Eisner, who's brilliant and wonderfully creative, but I don't think many hiring managers would have recognized it right away. But she brings so much creative problem-solving skills in the day-to-day work that she does, and we really greatly benefited from that. So it was more about recognizing the types of creativity in each person on the team and leveraging it.
Wow, that's such a great answer, because you're essentially recognizing or believing that everyone is creative and then looking for the ways to bring it out of them.
Exactly.
I love that. So what's next for Esther?
Yeah, so these days I'm doing a lot of marketing work for clients through a consulting firm called Tutavi, which is run by Matthew Goldman, who is kind of like an OG fintech influencer or finfluencer, if you will. He's absolutely wonderful. And I'm also exploring doing coaching. So now that I'm a little bit later in my marketing career, I would love to be able to help individuals who are maybe earlier in their career or exploring marketing potentially, or even people who are wanting to figure out ways to define what success could look like for them. So I launched my coaching business, NoBullWoman.com. And it's no bull as in no bullshit, because I think I probably work best with people who are looking for direct feedback. So I'm building my own brand for once rather than working on someone else's brand, which is very exciting.
That is very exciting. And you will have to come back in a couple months when you've got it up and running and to share that experience. But that's very
yeah,
exciting.
I'd love to.
Awesome. Well, if people would like to work with you, where can they find you?
They can find me at NoBullWoman.com. It's also meant to be a little bit of a pun, so I'm not going to give you any bullshit, so I'm a noble woman.
I love it. Years of brand marketing went into that one. Well, Esther, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been so fun.
I hope you enjoyed my episode with Esther Jang. Let me know what you thought of it and what lessons you took away. Thanks so much, and stay tuned for more lessons.